Zach Owens, I'm here with Nigel Ellis, architect on the SQL Data Services. Thanks for joining us, Nigel.
Hey, welcome.
So this is going to be aired a little bit after Mix, and we're making some big announcements. Mm-hmm. So what's going on? What are we going to be talking about there, and what are the impacts to our customers?
Okay, so pretty much a Mix. So what are we, like two weeks away?
2 weeks.
There's a lot of frenetic activity going on right now in the ramp up to Mix. But essentially what we're announcing at Mix is a change in direction from SQL Data Services. We announced in Mix 08 last year, so our first birthday, if you will. And what we're doing is SDS today, so SQL Data Services today, is a web-facing data storage service that you can talk to with REST-based protocols or SOAP-based protocols. And it has a very flexible data model, so pretty much a property bag data model. We call it a flex entity data model. And that service has been out for almost a year right now. And we've learned so much from that, both in terms of how to run a service, how to do it at scale. The feedback that we've gotten from the community has been fantastic. We've had a pretty successful CDP program that we started relatively modestly and then fully ramped that up to a full open CDP at PDC last year. And we've learned so much. And one of the things that we learned is pretty much people want more relational capabilities. So for those people that have been following SDS when we started, there was very little relational capabilities inside of it. You could do filter, you could return the whole entity. And
right.
The unit of operation was grab an entity, make a change to it, send the whole thing back. And people were really lacking a lot of the capabilities that we had in SQL Server today, right? The idea that I can project part of a row, I can do joins across tables, I can do aggregations. Heck, I can install business logic and store procedures and so on. So if I were to run my code really close to the data, I couldn't do that with SDS. And then also in the last year, something really interesting has happened. We launched the Azure platform, which was announced at PDC. And now that enabled us to have compute, so in terms of the ability to run an ASP.NET application, and being announced at Mix in 2 weeks, also running native code application like PHP and Ruby, we can co-locate your app running in a Microsoft data center with our data service. And that opened up a whole bunch of interesting opportunities for us. Also at PDC, Windows Azure announced the Simple Table Storage service, which if you looked at what we delivered with SDS at that time, and also the table storage service, they were pretty similar. A few things that we did a little bit different than Azure and so on, but for the most part, they're really aimed at the same target community. So we made a decision. We said, does it make sense to have two services that give us the same thing? No. Does it make sense to essentially keep on a path that largely is reinventing a lot of the tooling and application patterns that already exist in SQL Server today? And we said it doesn't. Now, one of the cool things that happened also in that same time frame is the internal platform that we use, the data storage platform. We call this CloudDB inside the company. That has now evolved to a point where we can actually offer rich relational capabilities directly through the service. And we've been working with one of our premier partners inside of Microsoft, Exchange Hosted Archive. There's actually a white paper that we'll post with the comments along with this video. We can look at what that application does, but it's basically a massively scaled out SQL Server application. And in developing that app, that allowed us to really take our relational capabilities to the next level. So what we're doing now, we announced announcing at Mix in 2 weeks, is we're saying the SDS current service with Flex Entity Model, that's going to be deprecated. We can talk a little while about the timeline for that and so on. And it's going to be replaced by a database service. So essentially, you'll be able to take your existing developer tools and patents. There's a little bit of a caveat here, but you can take your knowledge as a SQL Server developer, and provided you live within some of the compatibility constraints of what we can actually deliver in this V1 time frame, you'll largely be able to run that code unchanged.
So,
that's really cool.
And one of the things that it seems like we heard a lot of as we were talking about SDS over the last year was people liked it. They liked the ACE model and the REST and SOAP APIs, but they still didn't have an option when running Microsoft Cloud Computing to actually just move their app because they had this whole data tier that you couldn't just port over to a Flex entity property bag mm-hmm. model. So basically what we're offering now is SQL Server in the cloud in more of what SQL Server has looked like traditionally. Is that a fair way to put it?
Sort of, yeah. So in some sense, you could take your existing application patterns. So you have a DDL script to create tables and views and stored procedures and triggers and all the other good SQL Server stuff that exists within a database. You should be able to largely run those unchanged against our service. So you can walk up and say, I'd like to create a server. And of course, that's different than creating a server in your on-premise today.
Right.
You go get your DVD, you go install it, you enter your product key and so on. Clearly, that's not what we offer up in the cloud. You connect to some service portal, and then you sign up, or you'll be able to sign up relatively soon for a CTP. You can then provision a server, and that gives you a host name that you can connect to. And our goal is to let you use existing tools. So for example, if you use SSMS, so SQL Server Management Studio, we'd like you to be able to enter that server name and the credential that we create as a sysadmin into SSMS. Uh-huh. And be able to create a database the same way that you do today.
Okay.
And as soon as you create a database, you can think about how do I create all my tables and my stored procedures and stuff. And then sort of all of that stuff that you have as a SQL Server dev today, you can now use it. It's
right.
Really great compared to where we were previously. We said, well, if you've got an existing SQL app, hopefully you've put an abstraction layer in your data tier, like of course everybody does. And then what you'd have to do is port that over so it runs against this ACE model, this Flex Entity model. Well, now you'd largely be able to take the existing SQL Server access tier that you have and move that over, and our goal is for you not really to change a whole lot about it. And that, of course, is great for people that want to run an app on-premise and in the cloud, or even people that want the flexibility, maybe target the cloud initially and then think about, well, at some point, I might want to run that on-premise today, right? And the fact that they're very, very similar and over time get much closer and closer together, that's a really big advantage.
Right. So one of the things that you said that stuck out to me is that you would go up to a web application and provision a new database. So what's the difference between provisioning an SDS database versus just having a database that's hosted somewhere? Is there something behind the covers that makes SDS and its database model different? Is it one server? Is it a cluster of servers? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, that's a great question. So what we have behind the covers is we have this CloudDB platform. And in CloudDB, we have a notion of partitions, and then partitions have replicas associated with them. So if I think of having, say, partition one, and then inside of that I have a set of replicas, okay? So let's say we have four replicas, so replica one through replica four.
Okay.
And what the system does is when we place a partition into the cloud, into the SDS cloud, we put each of these replicas on a different machine. So for example, this might be on machine A, machine B, machine C, and machine D.
Sure.
Now why do we do that, right? One of the reasons we do that is for high availability. So if this machine goes down, and let's say it never comes back, machine blows up in a massive set of flames and so on.
Okay.
Is your data lost? Well, it isn't, because we have another set of replicas available to you. So your data is safe, right? And that's one of our core tenets of running any storage service.
Right.
Store a byte of data, and we guarantee within our terms of service, and if we can't do this, there's some financial penalty associated with it and so on, that whatever you store with us, we can faithfully return to you, right? And that's always been, I worked in the database field for a long time, and that's always been one of the things that we really worry about, right? If you're selling a database product and you have data corruption in there, bad news, you'll be out of business very quick, right? So we keep your data durable, so we keep multiple copies of it. Now the other thing, it's not sufficient just to keep it durable. How do you keep it highly available, right? Say, well, save your data. Don't worry, it's safe. That machine went offline, and it's going to be a week before we get it back up. It's not a really good solution, right? So we use these replicas here to offer high availability. So if this machine A goes down and we lose a replica, we then have a process called leader election that says we elect one of these other replicas here to be the new leader, right? And that leader election is just a fancy term for saying when a request comes in from the client. So for example, I have a client app here. And maybe it's using, say, ADO.net, and it's connecting to some server A, and it's connecting to database foo, right? Now this is connecting across the internet, so we have a little cloud here. Fortunately, I can't draw very well. this ultimately connects to an instance of the SDS service, right? And we happen to know that database foo is located within a specific partition. So if that machine A went down, how do we make sure that partition's available? Well, we pick one of these other replicas to be the new leader. And this request from the client, when it comes back in, it's actually routed through to this server D here, right? Now, if server D dies, of course, we can go through this again. Server C dies. Well, you might be asking the question, well, I'm running out of copies of my data. Well, what we do is we basically know that in the server topology, we want to keep a certain number of copies of your data. And the system recognizes if we drop below that count and we stay below that count for a configurable period of time, we'll create another copy.
Uh-huh. Right?
So we eventually we come back up to whatever number of copies we've considered. So this is a little bit different than regular SQL servers. If I install SQL Server today, or I go to a hoster and I run SQL Server in a VM, while the hosters may give you data durability, for example, the data might be stored on a SAN that they have up in their data center, they don't give you HA out of the box.
Right.
So if your VM goes down, how long does it take to come back up? Or does it even come back up? It might not.
Right?
So then you might have to deploy two VMs and then do SQL mirroring across them.
Right.
And one of the advantages we have here is that's already taken care of for you. So any server instance or database instance that you provision comes with this stuff by default.
Right.
Highly available, highly reliable.
And so it looks like, is there a cluster of servers that handles these database connections in their own right that represents a partition currently?
Yeah, exactly. So if we maybe expand on our picture a little bit here. So we've got our cloud, and we've got connections coming through. And what we have here is we have a bunch of servers in the front. We have essentially a load balancer. Okay, and technically there's actually a pair of these. Beneath that, we then have what are called our gateway servers.
Okay.
And this gateway tier here is completely stateless, right? So if we want to add more servers in there's no data being stored here. And when a request comes in from the client, it hits the load balancer, and then depending on what the load balancing policy is, it'll route your request through to a gateway node, right? Now, beneath the gateway, we actually have our data storage service, which is where all the stuff associated with the server A, B, C, and D that we had, and we have sort of a partition one here, replica A, partition one, replica B, partition two, replica A, and so on, right?
Sure.
So we have, logically, here we've got two replicas from the same partition, right? So when a gateway request comes in, so I'm in my application here, and I want to connect to server X, DB foo, this request comes into the gateway tier. The gateway tier then queries into CloudDB, and it says, hey, tell me where the partition for server X DB foo is located. That data then comes back, and then the gateway connects directly to that specific machine.
Got it.
And then if that machine dies, it goes back and it says, hey, tell me who the new machine is that's hosting my database for me. And then that request then gets routed again to the back end. So this is exactly the same infrastructure that we were using with SDS.
Uh-huh.
So the only difference is this tier is now changed. So this tier here now uses what we call the TDS protocol. So TDS is SQL Server Network Protocol. So it stands for Tabular Data Stream. And it's just a fancy name that says that's how all SQL Server clients talk to a SQL Server instance.
So currently ODBC.
ODBC, OLADB, yep. ADO.net. We've got an ODBC driver that ships for the PHP stack. You can access this from Ruby. You can access it from Linux using the OpenTDS driver and so on. And TDS also works over different network protocols. So Typically, people think of TDS running over TCP/IP, but it also works on named pipe, shared memory, a bunch of other things. Right. So what we changed here is this gateway tier is TDS over TCP/IP, right?
So that's new.
That's new. What this tier used to be was essentially REST and SOAP.
Uh-huh.
Right? So we moved from REST and SOAP being a stateless protocol to TDS, which is a session-based protocol. So you connect to the service, and then in the you keep reusing that connection to run queries, insert, update, deletes, and so on, and eventually you drop your connection. Whereas in the old service, SDS with REST and SOAP, it's stateless. Each transition is completely stateless. So there's been some really interesting challenges with us moving from, so we built a lot of knowledge in stateless services here, and now moving that to a stateful service. So that's actually been very interesting, and we got some really good learning there.
So what have been the key pieces of innovation since we decided to make this change from the REST and SOAP interface to more traditional TDS-based interface? So where are the interesting engineering challenges currently?
So some of the main challenges is sort of in this tier here, so in the gateway tier, how do we build this TDS stateful protocol tier? This tier is also responsible for provisioning, right? So in the existing SDS model where you have authority, container, and entity, that we had sort of a SQL Server application built over this CloudDB platform.
Sure.
So when I create an authority, we have to go provision a dynamic DNS record. We store some service metadata in a table. Well, we have the same thing again, but now rather than authority, container, entity, we have server and database.
Right.
Right? So there's some work going on in the gateway tier to deal with that. The other piece of interesting work going on is sort of in this back end, in this CloudDB. So what have we really done? We took this database here, this DB foo, and then we mapped this to a partition. Right? And what we're doing is we're a multi-tenant data service. So these servers here, these A, B, C, and D servers, and you know we can, in fact, in our clusters, we have large numbers of servers in order hundreds. Each one of those servers has replicas or partitions, or you could think of them as being used as databases on the same server, right? So if my database is on the same server as your database, I shouldn't be able to see your data, and you shouldn't be able to see mine, number one. Moreover, I shouldn't even know that you're on the same server as me, two. And number three, if you're on the same server, I don't want you hogging all the resources. I want it to sort of have fair resource utilization, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of work been going in over the last few months in how we actually make that happen. So we look at that from sort of security lockdown. How can we silo you? So that we're sort of guaranteed to be completely independent.
Uh-huh.
I can't detect your presence, you can't detect mine, and so on. And then also, how do we sort of load balance and throttle?
Uh-huh.
So if we find out that all of the databases on this server are really, really hot, there's a lot of frenetic activity going on. So using our existing leader election, so that's where we can move from one replica on one server being the primary to another server, we can move that workload off, right?
Right.
We don't have to kill that replica and drop it. We can just say, no, you're no longer the primary. The primary is now on server B, right? So if we were both actually hitting this server here, by moving your primary to server B, I now move this traffic over to here, right?
Sure.
So that's a primitive form of load balancing. But by leaving your replicas on server A, if you're doing a lot of updates and deletes and so on, I'm still having to replicate.
Right.
So we can also move your replica to another server, right? So that's two forms of load balancing. The other interesting thing going on is sort of the overall sort of security lockdown and so on. And one of the advantages that we have is we're part of the SQL Server team, right? So that comes with certain benefits and certain obligations, right? One of those benefits is that we have access to the SQL Server IP and the SQL Server code base.
Right.
Because we are using this to sort of extend the SQL Server business. So we have a snapshot of the SQL Server code base.
Uh-huh.
And where SQL Server doesn't deliver the capabilities we need, we can go at them, right?
Right.
And one of the cool things about this project is we have people who've worked on all kinds of different software, but there's also quite a fair number of people that worked on SQL Server for many years. Myself, I spent quite a while
right.
Building SQL Server. And that comes with a great advantage that we... We can influence the direction that the SQL Server product's going in.
Sure.
And say, hey, well, if this is useful for us, there's also scenarios where customers might like these capabilities themselves running on-premise and so on. So we can get feedback into the core product, and we can also take some of the IP that we're developing here and push it back into the core SQL Server product. The other one, too, is that, like I said, we can make those changes if they're not there, right? There's going to be certain things that are very specific to what we might need that might not make sense for an on-premise SQL Server. So this is sort of the core challenges. This tier here, scaling it out, and then also in the back end around the security, the fairness, the resource governance, and so on.
Sure. So we've sort of talked about the back end and what work we've had to do. What are some of the application patterns we think will be applicable to this new model, and what's the life of a developer going to look like?
Okay, that's a great question. So we have, there's really two core patterns that we can think of in our service today. I guess technically three. So I guess a lot of people use these terms code near, code far.
Okay.
And they're sort of like a very vague term, and what it really means is I have business logic in my application. Is it running close to my data, or is it running far away? And that's really defined as what's the latency.
Uh-huh.
Right? So a real extreme example is, so if I have my cloud here, and I have my app, and then I'm connecting all the way through to SQL Data Services, and this is the new guy, so we have our little TDS on here, right? This is code far, right? My application code is running a long way away from my data. Of course, you know, if you're in Seattle and we happen to have a data center in Western Washington, you're in the same state, but the point is there could be seconds of latency across those connections, right? So that's one pattern. The other interesting thing, as I mentioned earlier, is I have my app, but I also have Azure, right? And within Azure, I can now talk from my application to Azure, and basically I could use HTTP. That'd be a common pattern.
Uh-huh.
I could also support other protocols if I have some fancy service and so on. And then Azure can talk to SDS.
Right.
And at this point, the distance between this link here is now much closer. And in fact, we're going to be doing work to make sure that when you deploy an application in Azure and you provision a server in SDS, those two are co-located.
Right.
And what co-location really means is they're logically close together.
Uh-huh.
Now, does it mean they're in the same data center? It doesn't. It means that they're close, that there's low latency between the code and the data tier.
Okay.
So Microsoft has data centers all over the U.S., all over the world, and so on. And one of the problems is, of course, getting data center space, right? And
right.
System planning and so on. So we're trying to do a very good job between the Azure team and the SDS team to get our platform, if you will, co-load. Because
right.
We really think that SDS is a very important part of the Azure platform. So many apps out there need relational database and SQL Server specifically, and that's what SDS is all about.
So one of the patterns is that you have your customers who are accessing a web application running on Windows Azure, which is accessing SDS as its data tier.
That's right.
What are some other things people might be doing? Like some management tools. We've had this conversation around Management Studio. So what's that look like in this world?
So Management Studio is pretty much the same, right? So what we've really got here are two channels, right? This is TDS.
Yep.
This is HTTP, right? So HTTP talking to Azure, right?
Right.
And the fact that this is TDS means this app is talking directly to the database. And what are some apps that do that? Well, it could be your own code. Could actually be your own heck, this could be an ASP.NET app, right?
Right.
Talking with ADO.NET across the internet, right? And of course, it's code far, so there's going to be higher latency in that scenario.
Uh-huh.
Now, TDS as a protocol, it has patents for dealing with high latency connections. That is SQL Server. You can batch requests, right?
Right.
You can batch them either by putting your logic in a stored procedure, or you can send a multi-statement request through, as opposed to, say, execute query 1, get result, execute query 2, and so on.
Right.
But it's not going to be optimal in all cases, right? Now, another example of this app is this could be a management app. Right. So we talked about SSMS, right?
This is again using TDS. So these apps are really the same thing, right? You could think of this as being class of application here. So I'm using some code running on my desktop or within my own data center in an application server and so on.
Right.
It's using a SQL client library, which could be a managed library, so ADO.NET, or a native library, OLADB, ODBC. The code could be using PHP or Ruby or something like that, Java. And it's using the TDS protocol, and they're both code for our scenarios, right?
Right.
So in terms of the tooling that we'd like to get working, and this is sort of early, right? Our goal is to actually have what we call commercial availability by PDC.
Uh-huh.
So what that really means is Microsoft is gearing up to release the service and start charging for it.
Right.
And in terms of that, that means we need an SLA. So if people are going to pay us money, we sort of want a contract to say, we'll do our best to meet the following guidelines and goals and so on.
Right.
If we don't meet those, here's the financial penalty that will be due to Microsoft. So how might we pay you back for the fact that we lapsed on our agreement and so on? So that's all happening by PDC. So where we're at right now in the mixed time frame, we have some of these basic tools working, and we're working within sort of the SQL Server ecosystem to look at how much additional work we can do to light up some of these tools. Now, we don't have the full list of what's going to be available by PDC, but what I will say, for the tools that don't work in the PDC timeframe, it's just a matter of time.
Okay.
And we know our core target is to get SSMS working. We know that's the most common DBA and developer tool for essentially managing your SQL Server instance. And we'd like to be able to be in a position to have a version of SSMS
right.
in the PDC timeframe. So you can just fire that thing up, and it looks and feels exactly like the SSMS you use today to manage your SQL. Now, there's some things that aren't going to work, right? One of the things that I talked about in the mix presentation was management of SDS in the cloud is different than management of your on-premise SQL server. And we talk about this logical versus physical. So if you think about, you've got your server today, and you went and installed it, and you're like, well, where am I going to put my database? And If you're a real hardcore DBA, you'll think about how many spindles I have and whether it's on a RAID volume and what my backup policy is and all this other stuff, right? You don't have to think about that with SDS because that's all taken care of for you because of these replicas, we have backup and restore and so on within the data center. But so you're not so much worried about file management, so we think of that as being physical.
Mm-hmm.
You're worried more about policy-based management, right? I want to create a user. I want to provision security for my database. I want to lock things down. So moving out, taking away the physical DBA aspects, over time exposing those back to the DBA, but in terms of policy, right?
Okay.
So you think about, if I want to get something done, I can just go do it, or I can describe what I'd like to be done
uh-huh.
and have the system go figure it out. And this is something that in the SQL Server family and the Windows family of products, we've really been trying hard to move to policy-based management because these products are so difficult.
Right.
There's only so many knobs, certainly for me, right? At some point, there's too many knobs, and I can't figure out what the optimal setting is. I think there's some folks out there that really love the fact that there's a lot of knobs, and they can build a business around it. Some of our competitors have built quite a good business around that, in fact.
Sure.
But one of the things we've been really committed to doing is moving to this sort of policy-based management system. And I think there's some really unique opportunities we have with SDS running in the cloud. We can understand a lot more about the system. We've added more instrumentation. And some of this work was done in early days in SQL Server, and you've seen SQL Server evolve that.
Uh-huh.
There's some unique things that we're going to be doing in the services space that we think is going to allow us to deliver some great value here. Yeah.
So if I'm sitting down to write an application today, what are my options for writing an application against SDS, or what do I need to keep in mind? So we sort of talked architecturally what the patterns might look like, but getting down to a little bit more of the details, what does that mean for us?
So our sort of our near-term deliverables are really going to be focused on, think about SQL compatibility. You could look at it at two rough levels. There's compatibility at the server level,
uh-huh.
and there's compatibility within a database. Now, if you sort of drill down into that, what does that really mean? So at the server level, what we're talking about is I connect to the server, and for most people what this means is I connect to the master database, right? The master database has this huge surface area. It's got all these stored procedures and DMVs and all this sort of goop inside of it. There's a whole set of APIs that I can call there. Some of the APIs have nice DDL associated with them, right? For example, create user, add full text index to database, and so on. And what you've seen for folks that are familiar with SQL Server over the last few releases, we've taken what I would call poor man's DDL in terms of stored procedures that were added.
Sure.
And we're turning those into language syntax so you can give people good actionable error messages. So when we look at that compatibility at the server level and the database level, what we're really saying is a lot of the things you can do at the server level today, we won't support in this V1 timeframe. Some of those will come later with time.
Okay.
Some of them won't come because they no longer make sense in this service-oriented world.
Right.
Right. Now, one other consequence of this is that, remember we're talking a little bit about your logical database has replicas on many different servers. Well, if you think about your SQL server in the cloud, this virtual server that you connect to, that virtual server can have many databases, right? Just like it can in SQL Server today.
Right.
Those databases are going to be on a whole bunch of different servers. So now think about what that means. You connect today to a SQL Server instance, and you can do cross-database queries, right?
Right.
So I'm in database A, and I can do a join across table from database A and table from database B. Now, in this world in the cloud, they happen to be on different servers. So
okay.
That would actually be a distributed query, which we don't actually support in this cloud topology yet.
Okay.
Now, we think we know how to actually enable that in a robust way, sort of moving forward. But in this time frame, that won't be there. So no cross-database query.
Okay.
Another consequence is once you've logged into a database, so if you don't specify the name of the database, we'd log you into, say, master. There'd be a default database. But once you're in your target database with that connection, you're in database A and you say use B, you're going to get an error. And the reason for that is we can't transparently just move you from one server to another. Well, we could. But remember, TDS and SQL Server as a session protocol,
right.
The state on your session, right? So it's an example of state. So you've got all your set options. What's my month date format? What's my ANSI null settings? There's a long, long list of these options. But other state happens to be persistent data, so tempdb state, so session level temporary tables. So I've created a table pound foo, and I've stored some data inside of it. And the semantics of that says, while that session's active, that table lives. As soon as my session drops, it gets deleted. So if I'm on server one with my pound foo table, and I say use database B, I'm going to move you to another server, how do we move that state from that table across? Well, the answer is we could, but we're not going to. some of these things are actually solvable, but
That's not a really common application pattern in general, a lot of database context switching within the same connection. So it doesn't sound like too bad of a trade-off for the benefits of having a database in the cloud with the high availability. So what things are create tables, regular selects, updates, is all that stuff going to work? Joins are going to work. So we haven't really got to that sort of concept yet, just that you essentially have SQL Server. What is going to work?
So the stuff that's going to work is pretty much all of the common patterns, right? So if we forget about cross-database queries and changing your database context, you can create tables, you can create stored procedures, great indexes, you can alter those, so you can do all those DDL operations on them, right? In large part, you'll be able to use all the intrinsic functions that you have. Some catalog functions that you have may not work, so I'll give you an example. So in SQL, being a mature product, so SQL Server came from a Sybase server all the way back, SQL Server 4.2.1, Ashen Tate edition for OS2, right?
Right.
All the way up to running on the Windows platform. You've got 20 years of what's really an application server there. So consequently, there's a lot of ways of doing things, right? So if you take a task and you say, what's the object ID of some table, right? There's at least two ways of doing that. I can call the object ID function. I can go to one or more system tables and resolve that.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to spend the time to go enable all of those scenarios? The answer is, over time, probably. In the near term, no. So what we've done is we've looked broadly at a set of applications that people are building, and we call these things work group applications.
Okay.
And we did a whole bunch of interviews with customers. We've got profiler traces, database dumps, and so on. And we've sort of been combing through them, and we're looking at the common patterns that people use. And the set of functionality we want to deliver, we believe will address 95% of those application scenarios, right? So 95% is a pretty big number of a large set of apps that we've been looking at. Where we fall short are in some of these esoteric use cases, right?
Right.
Looking at server property, calling server DDL, doing cross-database queries and things like that. Now, in a lot of cases, we think there's patterns that people can change their code, and those changes are fairly modest.
Uh-huh.
In other cases, some of them are more invasive. So if I'm in a situation where I have an app and I'm doing distributed transactions from server 1 to server 2, I'm not going to get distributed transactions in the cloud in this time frame.
Right.
Do we think that's a common pattern? Absolutely not. We think that's a very, very small scenario. So we're pretty confident the set of stuff we're going to deliver for PDC, so for this V1 thing, it's going to cover a very broad set of applications. But it won't be all those apps, right? So a lot of it's going to be up to people to look at what we have, look at their app patterns, and say, well, what would it take for me to move my app to the cloud? And our goal is to make it as easy as possible. And in the case we do have to change some things, hopefully it's just moving from pattern A to pattern B. So one of the things that we're looking at doing is document the things that don't work.
Right.
We have a very easy set of patterns and practices. So if you think about porting an app, you could look at it the other way. I want to write a new app. So if there's patterns that I could use today in my on-premise SQL Server, and they're just as functional as other patterns I could choose, wouldn't you want to pick the one that's also going to work up in the cloud?
Right.
Well, we're sort of going to be building that guidance. You could think of those as being a set of blueprints, and then eventually looking at supporting a richer tooling experience. So, you know, developers don't typically read documentation. I know I'm sort of a sinner in that regard, but moving to a tooling solution, so whether it be sort of an upgrade advisor, I could run an analysis of my apps and would say the following five things have some warnings associated with them, right? All the way to sort of more of an interactive design time experience. So this
right.
is sort of a vision we have for tools. We're not necessarily going to get all of that this calendar year, but it's very achievable in the sort of the tooling and ecosystem we have.
Okay, so then let's get down to some real details. So if someone's out there watching this interview, either I'd say they fall generally into two categories. One is that they've built an app that's running on SDS. Or two, they're thinking about building an app on SDS.
Yep.
So what is the actionable things they can do? Will they be able to get into SDS now? What about the customers who have already used our REST and SOAP APIs?
Yep.
What should developers actually be taking action on?
Okay, so that's a good question. So for those people that are, I guess I'd sort of split the customers up into two scenarios. There's those people that are using SDS today
mm-hmm.
as a storage service. They're consuming our service using SOAP and REST because that's the protocol that we supported.
Right.
They're using the ACE data model, the FlexNAD data model, because that's the model we supported. Right. They're not so particular about the protocol and the data model. They just need data storage, they need query processing, and so on. For those customers, the actionable thing is to start to look at how they would build their application as a regular SQL Server application.
Mm-hmm.
And some we'll talk about in my mix talk, I actually talked about some of the guidelines of things to maybe avoid and considerations and so on. They can take that those best practices, and we'll get more specific as we get closer to PDC. And they could start to build their app using SQL Express or regular SQL Server. I think in many cases, a lot of those customers already had SQL, already have SQL knowledge, and they had to change to this other data model.
Uh-huh.
So for them, it should be moving back to something that they're very comfortable and very, very familiar with. For the other scenarios, the people that wanted the benefits of essentially the Flex Entity model and the whole notion of using RESTful and SOAP protocols is very important to them. And I would characterize those individuals as primarily being in this code far scenario.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that we look at for that is to say, We now have sort of Azure Compute. You can now deploy essentially your own protocol head, which talks through ADO.NET to SDS. And by protocol head, here I mean if I want to use REST, I can use essentially what we call Astoria, which for those folks that don't know, Astoria was the project code name for the ADO.NET Data Services Framework.
Right.
Which was essentially a framework pattern that let you to take that enabled you to take a data service or data source. It could be a CLR, IEnumerable, IQueryable thing, or it could be an entity framework, ADO.NET V3 instance of an EDM data model, and build essentially a RESTful interface over the top of that.
Right.
So you could use that, the Astoria framework, to deploy an app into a web role
within
into
Azure Compute.
And then that could talk with TDS, and this would give you your REST protocol. Or similarly, I could also build a SOAP head here, right? I could build a WCF web service. And what would the data model be exposed by these services? Well, that's basically left up to the implementer of this. If it's Astoria, it's the EDM data model, the SQL Server Entity Data Model, and so on. If it's SOAP, then it's whatever people want, right? So that would be sort of the other pattern for RESTful and SOAP protocols in a code FAR. You could, of course, also use this in a code NEAR scenario. But it does beg the question, certainly, why would I use a REST protocol in a code NEAR scenario? SOAP, I think you can make a case for web services sort of interaction and sort of gluing those services together. So those are the two things. So SDS uses today. Want to move to essentially SDS relational model, get started with SQL Server. As we evolve our patents and practices and so on, sort of pay note to those and so on. But largely, if you can build a relational database today with SQL Express, it's free, get started, right? And then the other patents are for people who are actually using Azure. They can go sign up, get an Azure Compute account, and then they can start experimenting with deploying a web role and so on.
So if someone was going to take your advice, Well, I guess there's a couple of things to point out. So there won't be a public CTP available of the new SDS right away. Is that true? Is that why you're recommending people would
use absolutely.
Express?
So we came back to Mix and sort of our first anniversary of a service, and we announced a change. But based on where we're at in the product dev cycle, we're now in a situation where we have the new SDS relational SQL Server clusters up and running inside of Microsoft. So the certain individuals that we're working with right now that have access to that technology early, but I'd say that they're the super early adopters. Our goals are to have essentially a CTP available in the May-ish timeframe.
Okay.
And that'll enable existing customers of SDS plus some new customers that perhaps aren't using SDS today to actually start using the technology. And from that point on, from when we open the cluster up in May, there'll be a data migration or an app migration period, right? Now, of course, as we mentioned, if you're already on SDS today, you can easily get your data out. In fact, we give you tools to do that. And you can actually convert your application to relational already. If you get started, you're going to be well ahead of the curve there.
Right.
If you choose to delay, fine, you're still going to have some number of months to actually get your data out and then migrate your application patterns over. And then that'll sort of be a ramped deployment, the same way we did with our current SDS service, where we started with an invitation-only CDP. We sort of made it more broader all the way up to open CDP. That ramp-up will happen through this calendar year as well.
Yeah. Okay. So from my understanding, we're not going to be publishing specific guidance right around Mix in terms of which features we are going to support, the details in terms of which SQL Server features we're going to support. So what would be your guidance to someone who wants to start building an app, they're going to use SQL Express or SQL Server, and what things should they stay away from, or what things are they safe to make a bet on right now that we will support?
I think the easier thing to say is what to stay away from.
Right.
Because there's some sort of heavy hitters. So cross-database operations, switching database context once you've connected, distributed transactions, service broker, SQL CLR. Those are five of the key things we've already identified that are going to be out of scope in the V1 time frame. Now, they don't mean that they're never going to be supported. So if we take SQL Service Broker, if we take the SQL CLR, for example, right, so SQL CLR lets you take manage code and write essentially a stored procedure or a table-valued function. right? Mm-hmm. Super, super valuable in terms of extensibility and so on. Why don't we support that now? Let's really, remember we were talking about resource governance and load balancing and throttling? There's more work that we have to do in terms of resource governance of CLR, because we've got SQL Server and it's got its own OS.
Right.
And it's hosting a CLR inside of it. There's some more complexities that we have to deal with. We believe we know how to support that. It's just not going to get done in the time frame that we have, because we're on a pretty aggressive schedule for PDC. That'll come later. Things like Service Broker, unclear what the time frame might be there. May never be supported, but you know, people might tell you never say never. Distributed transactions, not really sure yet. But other than that, focusing on your application, using common patterns around tables, stored procedures, triggers, and so on. Staying away from what you might think of as being special purpose metadata functions around querying objects inside the system catalog and so on. If you stay within more of the vanilla intrinsic functions, date functions, left functions, substrings, things like that, you should be fine, right? There's nothing special about those functions that would prevent them being easily supported in this environment.
Great. So we've gone over the sort of details and actionable things and sort of got down to the nitty-gritty of what you've been working on for the past few months at least. And you've been doing this whole cloud DB thing for a while now. Yep. Without getting into maybe some things that are proprietary future plans of ours, what is your vision of the future of cloud storage and the future of cloud computing? And what do you see 5 or 10 years out? What's sort of the model of application development and what sort of Nigel's vision of the future world?
I think it's a pretty exciting space because for me, the reason I joined this project, so I'd worked in SQL Server for a long time before I did this, and prior to Microsoft, I'd owned a little consultancy and I built database apps, and then I said, well, I really like these database things. Let's go figure out how to go build one. So I came to Microsoft. I had a lot more hair back then. and I learned how to build a database system. And then this whole services thing came along. I said, boy, services is really exciting. Because I think I saw a lot of the possibilities of what could be enabled up in the cloud. Right? And you know, I know it's very early days, right? There's a lot of people, a lot of customers that I talk to, like, we'll never, ever move our servers off-premise up to the cloud. Well, turns out they're already doing it, right? In many cases, they're buying co-load server space in somebody else's data center, right? Well, but they still have people that they have under contract to manage their servers. Well, it's only a little step from them moving up to the cloud. So I see that wave already happening. In terms of where it's going, so like a lot of the things that we're focusing sort of in terms of futures roadmap, sort of geolocation is really important. So all this discussion around code near, code far, what happens if I'm a company and I have users of my app and my data and they're East Coast or West Coast or Europe and Australia?
Uh-huh.
Right? One of your customers is always going to be in a code far scenario. And for many apps, that's never acceptable. Right? So how do we solve that? Well, we replicate to two different geolocations.
Uh-huh.
Well, is there one copy of the truth or is there two copies of the truth, right? So the sort of the state of the art that people have today is they have primary and then they have secondary data centers. And what that really means is if you want to go make an update, go to the primary.
Sure.
If you want to read, you can also go to the secondary. Now, I think we can do a lot better than that. There's a lot of technical hurdles in making that happen. The other thing that's really important, too, is if we think about cost. So I know a lot of customers are concerned about cost. I know I think about it a lot. But what is it cost us to build this data service? What can we charge to be cost competitive, right? We're not in the business of losing money.
Uh-huh.
That wouldn't be a profit. That wouldn't be a good business strategy for us, right? But at the same time, we really want to drive the cost down for our customers, right? You see commoditization occurring all over the industry right now. And one of the big cost drivers is how many copies of data do you have to store, right? So think about when I said, don't worry, every piece of data you store is safe because we replicate it.
Right.
Okay? Well, what happens if we were to lose a data center? Well, we say, okay, fine, we've got backups. But it might take us a little while to get that data center restored. So we think about using geo-replication as a mechanism that lets us keep fewer copies, but also give you high availability, right? So there's a lot of work that we're thinking about how we can actually deliver that in a seamless way that, in some sense, apps would seamlessly fail over. That would be really cool, right?
Right.
A lot of scenarios today, you've got to write your app and say, I know about data center one, and I know if data center one's not available, I go to data center two. Or wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to worry about that?
Right.
I talk to a name or a URI, if you will, a DNS name, and magic stuff happens. That would be really cool. The other thing that we have going on is work looking at data processing. So SQL Server is a storage system, but it's also an app server. So if you think about where we're going to be at in this time frame, as a user of our service, you can sign up. You can provision several virtual servers, so they're names you can connect to, and each server can have several databases. Those databases are going to be limited in size, and we're thinking in the V1 time frame, sort of 10 gig or so.
Okay.
I think for a lot of people probably watching this video, 10 gig sounds awfully small. Well, it's actually interesting because obviously we went and we looked at the market studies and so on. 95% of the apps that we're looking at, which are the work group style applications, the average size of those apps is 2 to 3 gig.
Uh-huh.
Right? And 2 to 3 gig of structured data is a lot, right? So we think 10 gig gives us sufficient headroom. But let's say you're an app where 10 gig isn't enough. Well, you would then go create multiple databases, right? And then you would have to have code in your application that figures out how to connect to those different database partitions, if you will.
Right.
Right? So what we did there is we said, well, CloudDB in the base knows about partitioning. We expose simple databases in the V1 timeframe, and then some apps would use those simple databases to partition. Wouldn't it be great if you could create a partition database?
Uh-huh.
And then you can connect to that database, and you can run your queries, and then it distributes those queries against all the partitions and gathers the data back up. So that's sort of in the roadmap. And this is, if you look at sort of the history of SDS, we started with a simple data service, right? And now we're moving to the relational service. And why is that? Because the cloud infrastructure we have beneath us has matured, uh-huh. and it's to a point where we can offer that. Well, it already has partitioning, so the next logical step is to move from those simple user databases to partition user databases, again exposing more of the underlying plumbing that we have inside the system. So I think also this Azure Services platform, there's a lot of really cool stuff happening, because one of the things that Azure just announced at Mix, when they did the initial compute service, they only supported partial trust for managed code, so that limited use of, say, third-party assemblies and so on for managed code apps.
Uh-huh.
But it also didn't allow you to run any native code, right? So they've just announced now that they support partial trust, full trust, and native code. And in my Mix talk, I'm going to be demoing a PHP application, which I think you're going to be helping with. So that's cool. So that lets you run native code. And then if we think about how that virtualization service is going to evolve, supporting VMs, right? And then once we've got VMs up there, if we can use a lot of the cool stuff that we have in SDS around the HA service, so we can have failover going on between VMs and so on, and pretty much be in a position, hopefully within a couple of years, where you should be able to take everything that you run on-prem today from a software perspective, and in large part run it or an equivalent form up in the cloud, that would be great. Now, I don't for a second believe everything that you run on-premise will all magically move to the cloud. That's going to take a long time. And I think there'll still be examples, you know, several years from now where there's good reasons to have your data on-premise. A lot of legal implications.
Right.
You know, a lot of businesses, financial and privacy laws kick in and so on. So one of the things that we've been looking at doing with Azure and SDS and sort of, we talked a little bit about geolocation.
Uh-huh.
Another implication of geolocation is for legal purposes, right? So in the U.S. we have this thing called the Patriot Act, right? So if you go ask any Europeans if they feel comfortable storing their data in a U.S. data center, and they pretty much say no, with a poor French accent. And the reason for that is that they're worried about the privacy of their information.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons that we want to have European data centers. There's also sort of regional implications of that. So if you think of Europe as being a region, North America being a region, and then sort of APAC, Asia Pacific is another region, there's at least three that we know of. There's probably others, and they're really around sort of legal legal guidelines. So sort of winding forward, you know, many years from now, I'd like sort of cloud computing and cloud storage to be ubiquitous. So wherever you are, whatever SLA you need, whatever legal compliance you need, pretty much whatever scenario you have, and that's sort of a pretty bold statement, cloud computing and cloud storage should be able to help you with that problem.
Uh-huh.
It may not be the whole solution, right? And one of the things that we're very interested in doing with SDS is sort of tying it into our on-premise SQL offering, right? So we have this project underway called Data Hub.
Uh-huh.
And Data Hub is essentially a project that leverages our sync technologies that we have. So we have something called the Microsoft Sync Framework. And that's essentially an open set of APIs that let you build sync providers for your data source and let you synchronize between arbitrary storage services. Right? And it deals with data transformation and so on. So you could think of it being like a sync codec. So you think of audio codecs and video codecs.
Right.
You can have sync codecs that do data transformation. And we're sync enabling SDS from the start. We're also looking at SDS as being one of the world's most reliable sync partners. It's a highly available, geo-available, eventually, service. So it's going to be available to everybody worldwide, right? So if you and I want to synchronize some information, we may never be directly on the same network.
Right.
Or we may be intermittently connected and so on. But we should be able to go to SDS and sync through SDS. So that's sort of the sync through intermediary scenario. And also now that data, once it's in SDS, we can also build application patterns on top of it. And that's really cool. So I get really excited about that.
Nice. Yeah. I appreciate your time, Nigel.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're